each with different skills and expertise.
Welcome to Moe's Paisley Penny Arcade. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Moe's Paisley Penny Arcade. Mwah, mwahaha, mwahaha, mwahaha. That's the sound of people trying to take over the world. Mwahaha. And luckily I'm not one of them, but I thought I'd make that sound anyway, just so you know what what it sounds like. Hey, how you doing? Today is Wednesday the 5th of February, 2025. How's it going, friends? And how's it going, folks? And how's it going, folksy friends and frenzy folks? Hope you're having a wonderful day. It's windy here where I am. The wind is blowing. It's in the 60s, warm 60s, actually. Pretty darn nice, if I do ask myself, and I do ask myself all the time, what's going on, and what was I just thinking, and what's my name again, and how's it going? Yeah, those types of things. Hey, hope you're having a good day. There's so much to talk about, and I'm not going to talk about it. I'm just not going to do it. There's a lot of things on my mind, and I'm not going to talk about them. Because you know what? Let's let others talk about those things. Boy, there's a lot of things buzzing in my head, and a lot I could talk about with gritted teeth. But I'm not going to do it. Because, you know, let's let other people talk about those things. Like a walk in the park. Things like a kiss in the dark. Kisses in the dark. Ooh, wee baby. Don't I remember kisses in the dark? Doggone it. Don't I remember kisses in the dark? Ooh. I was a fan of the kiss in the dark. Or the kiss in the light. It didn't matter. Kissing was fun. Nowadays, you just can't do that so much. You know. Get to be kind of, oh, yeah. We kiss, oh, is that sloppy? And, you know, and who do you kiss anymore? And what was the nature of that kiss? And how did that, you know, sit with people? And, you know, yeah, you can't even talk about such things. That creepy old man, he's talking about kisses again. Shut him up. Shut him up. Shut him up. So, I hope you're doing well. I hope you're faring well in these really strange times. Are they strange? You tell me. Yeah, I think they're pretty strange. And, you know, the best thing to do sometimes is just kind of go on along the best you can and just say, you know, it'll be fine. And you know what is going to be fine, ultimately? Oh, there are going to be some odd things that happen here and there and everywhere. And that's how it goes, you know. It's getting really bizarre, isn't it? I think it's getting just as weird as can be. I mean, there's a lot I'd like to talk about. There's a lot of things I'd love to address. I would really, God, I'd, Jesus, boy. But I decided today I'm just not going to do it. Because, number one, I might say some things that I'd regret. You know, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong. Yes, come with us, you know, that sort of thing. And, but I also just don't feel like, you know, bringing it down. There's a lot of things I will address eventually, but it just doesn't seem like the right thing at this point to do. So I'm not going to. At this point. But eventually, at some point, I'm going to do it. that's what I'm going to do. And maybe not in this venue. It's probably not the right venue, except that I'm have a head full of bumblebees. But the absurdity, the buffoonery, that's a great word, buffoonery. Tarot cards. I like tarot cards. 78 cards, that'll tell you anything you'd like to know. 78 cards that'll show you the show. Tarot cards. Put them down, Mo. Oh, my goodness. The world is such a remarkable place. God almighty. I mean, just like, oh, my God, what's going on? So here we are, you and I, friends, and we are friends. Here we are in the middle of one of the strangest times I can ever remember. And I'm pushing 71. I'll be 71 in May. And I've never seen such odd times at all. I saw a picture today of Taylor Swift and Bobby Weir. Bobby Weir, the rhythm guitar player for the Grateful Dead. And here's an incredible picture. Taylor Swift, who is one of the most popular musicians ever in the history of music. God bless her. And here is Bobby Weir, one of the last three surviving members of the Grateful Dead. God bless him. I'm a Deadhead, and I've been a fan of Bob's for a long time. And his music that he made with Jerry Garcia and the rest of the gang. And people were snarky. They were horribly snarky. They were terribly snarky. Bob needs to cut his mustache. I can't see his lips. So what? I have a big old bushy mustache. Well, it's mustachey. It covers my lip. And so what? I love my mustache. I love my beard. My beard is long now. I haven't trimmed it up since June of last year. And you know what? I may not trim it for a while longer, and I haven't had a haircut in about 8 months. And you know what? I used to be a hippie, and I mean a hippie. I was a freak. And I couldn't believe how snarky people were. Is she smiling for real? Is she, you know, and Weir always looks kind of, he doesn't smile very often anymore, but he's an old man. And we're all getting old men-ish, you know, and we with hair like that. And they let his beard grow, and he used to have just kind of a mustache button. And the people were snarky. It's like, why are people so snarky? Be nice. Here she is. Maybe she's a deadhead, you know? Maybe she's a deadhead. And I guess she went out with John Mayer. And John Mayer plays with the Grateful Dead. And he was a big Jerry Garcia fan. And it was Snarkville. Snarkville. And I thought, what is wrong with people? I don't like it. You know, there's a show on TV. There are three shows on TV called The FBI. And they're violent. Oh, my God, they're violent. And my wife said, do you mind if I not watch this one? Because I had something to do. You know, I had some things I needed to do. I said, oh, please, go ahead and watch it without me. And I did, you know, it's like, it's terribly violent. And I was like, I don't need to watch violence. I just am not into it. You know, I was like, go ahead and watch it. I don't want to see a bunch of people murdered. I just am not into it. The real world is weird enough, you know, just weird. And it's like, no, I don't need to see that. I mean, oh my goodness. Great honk. It is so strange nowadays. And I'm not for, you know, I'm not one of these, you know, just, you know, put a record on the old vinyl machine and you know, put the needle on and I don't, that's not me. I like streaming music. I like all that stuff. I pay for the service every month and I may listen to music, I may not. Right now I'm looking at my gadget because it's on my screen, and it's Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks Canned Music, you know, which is a pretty good song. One of my favorite songs by him is called Evening Breeze. It's a good old song about how he let his girl go. You know, Dan Hicks, you don't know Dan Hicks? Dan Hicks was one of the original San Francisco. He was with the Charlatans, which was the band, and he hung around. He was from Dallas, I think, originally, and they called him Shorty, but he was about 6'5", 6'6", 6'7", something like that. What a sound. What a great sound he had. Yeah, a good band. And, you know, one of the original Brown there with the Grateful Dead and Quicksilver Messenger Service and Hot Tuna and all those guys, you know. I mean, it was what a time it was. What a time to be free. What a time to be open. And what a time to say, I don't like the way things are, so let's make music. You know, Jefferson Airplane, Volunteers of America, you know. See all that coming down the street. What a revolution. Got to revolution. Volunteers of America. I mean, it was a time. It was a time to be alive. It was a time to be young. Oh, my God, was it a time to be young? Was it a time to be young? It was alive. It was being there. It was being aware. Man, was it fun. And it was dangerous in ways, not like it is today. I mean, it's dangerous today in a different way. But what can you say about everything? It's just the way it is. Time marches on, and it marches right over us if we're not aware and alert. But boy, what a time it was. And the music kind of reflected that. Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, when he wanted to play. And, you know, Chicago. Song Chicago, you know. So our brother's roped and tied, and they've chained him to a chair. Won't you please come to Chicago just to sing? We can change the world, rearrange the world, because the world is dying, you know. That's dying to be, you know, free. And just the time, the music of the time was about changing things. The music of the time was about movement. Man, oh man, oh man. Sly and the Family Stone. Oh, my God. I mean, things were happening. Carl Santana, Woodstock music, 1969. It was quite a time. Jimi Hendrix. A lot of people don't get Hendrix. A lot of people don't like Janis Joplin because they don't like her voice. But holy mackerel. She was incendiary. She was really something. I loved Janis Joplin. I knew a girl in college who had lived in Janis Joplin's apartment in San Francisco. She went to a school down there, and there was just a big yellow star painted on the front door. And she'd still get fan mail for her, and they never opened it. They just left it on the hearth. And this girl was kind of wild and nutty. She ended up not ending up that way, which I guess is good for her, you know. Good for her. So the times are always changing and strange. They're always changing. Lewis Carroll did that a lot. He mixed words together. He invented a lot of words, like chortle. We still use the word chortle. He invented that word. But times are always weird, but it's up to us to kind of decide how we're going to live in those weird times. It's up to us to decide how we're going to navigate those times, how we're going to live in those times, how we're going to be in those times, how we're going to decide those times, you know? I think that's an important part of being who we are. And when I say who we are, well, you know who we are. We're a little bit different. If we weren't a little bit different, you wouldn't be listening to me now. There are people who probably tune in live and they say, oh, this guy, this weird guy, you know, he doesn't come on and do readings. You know, I used to, I enjoyed it. I really did back when I could do readings, when I had the phone line, and I could probably figure out how to do that now, but, and that was fun. I enjoyed it, and I was good at it, to be quite honest with you. I still am good at it, to be quite honest with you, but getting older and things I want to do are a little bit different, I suppose. But back in those days, back in those days. I was a bit different, I guess. I think that what happens is that you begin to change a little bit, and you have this feeling that you just want to be telling your truth. You just want to talk about what's important in the moment to you. And right now, what's important in the moment is to connect. To connect with a group, to connect and say, here we are, and you know who you are. So someone gets on, he says, oh, he's not talking, or he's talking, you know, gobbledygook. But to me, it's not gobbledygook. It's not just fal-de-ral or la-di-da. It's important because we know who we are. We know who we are, and you know who you are. And you know that there are people out there in the world who you connect with, and people with whom you do not connect with. And those people with whom you do not connect with, you're sometimes forced to live with. You're forced to work with. You're forced to deal with on a daily basis, or every now and then, or a lot. And it's hard. So when we can get together and talk, when we get together and just kind of, you know, hang around, it's a good thing. And when you tune in and you hang on and you listen to me, or you tune in and you listen some night, or you tune in and you listen for a while or whatever, there's something good that happens. We energetically bond. We energetically connect for a little while. And there are people who don't always get it. And you know what? It doesn't matter. Good for them. God bless them. Even if there is a God. I don't know if there's a God. Do you know that? Some people are just really sure. And the people who are really sure are often really extra sure that God is on their side. And those people, I'm happy for them. I've always said I wish I could really be as sure about things like that as they are. But I can't be. And I think that means that I'm as little bit discerning about things, and doesn't mean that I wish I could be that sure about things, but I can't be. I just can't be, because I think about things, and it doesn't mean I think more about things than they do, but it just means that I can't be as certain about things as they are. I just can't do it. It doesn't work for me that well. It just doesn't. I've tried. There have been brief moments when it's been really clear, when I've believed in all sorts of things, and then a little later it kind of goes like, wow, I don't know. You know, it's just hard for me. And then you meet other people and it's hard for them too. There used to be a guy at LSU, he'd come through the South. He'd hit universities and he'd stand on a bench and he'd preach. His name was Reverend Jeb. Maybe you hit him, or he hit your school when you were in college too. And he would stand on a bench or stand on whatever was taller than you, because boy, he was better than you. And he'd tell you that too. He'd say, "I'm better than you." And back in the day, I would argue with people about things. I don't know why, but I would. And so I'd argue with Reverend Jeb. And he would talk about how he'd literally thump his Bible. He'd thump it against his thigh. He'd thump his hand against it. And he would use that Bible. And I never saw him open it up and refer to it. He just used it as a prop. But I'm sure he knew it. But he would point at you, and he knew me by name because we talked often. He'd come through about 3 times a year. And he'd talk about how I was going to hell, and a lot of people are going to hell, and anyone who didn't accept things were going to hell. And I don't even want to get into it, but he was just so sure about things, and he would exhaust himself. And I asked him once if I could go down and buy him a cup of coffee, and he said, "I don't drink the devil's drink." I said, "What do you drink?" He said, "Well, I drink water." I said, "Can I go get you a glass of water?" He said, "I'm afraid I can't accept that from you because you're a sinner." And I said, "Well, I am a sinner, I'm sure. But can I get you something? Can I get you anything? And he said, well, that's nice of you, but no. And I said, okay. And I just felt so, I don't know what I felt. It was a strange feeling, to be honest with you. Because here I was trying to help the poor guy, and he just wouldn't. And yet later on, I saw him down in there, and he was by himself. He was reading the Bible. And he felt so closed off. And no one was sitting with him, and he didn't want anyone sitting with him. And there was something about it that just felt so hurtful to me. And that was his life, I guess. Although I'll never know what his real life was, but I don't want to know. It's something I didn't want to feel. I don't know. I don't know what the point of that is, other than it felt sad to me. And I thought, if that's what certainty is, if that's what his truth was, then let it be. My dad was a good man. He was a truly, truly wonderful human being. And Jeb would have told me that my dad was going to hell because he wasn't a Christian. He was a Muslim. And he wasn't a fanatic, and he wasn't anything else. And my dad didn't pray five times a day, and he didn't do all that stuff. But he was a man with a good heart. And my dad helped people. And he followed right and wrong all the time. I mean, he did the right thing all the time. And you think to yourself, is it more important to do what's right, or is it more important to tell people what's right? And I think it's more important to do what's right, you know, than to tell people what right is and to pretend to do it. I don't know. I'm just, this is how I feel. And the world is just right now strange. So I think we are the type who like to do the right thing. And we don't always do the right thing. We do the best we can. We know what right and wrong is, and we know it when we see it. But we do our best. And we believe in a strong ethic. And we do believe in other things. I mean, there are things that I know exist that I cannot explain, like 78 cards that tell me things. And how they do it? I don't know. I don't care to know. It doesn't make a damn bit of difference to me how I know. I know that there are things that exist that I can't explain, like the jinn, as a certain sort of race, that you don't mess with, and you don't taunt, and you don't make up stories about and sell books about when you have no idea what you're talking about. But people do it anyway. And that's okay. It doesn't matter to me. It's not my business what people do to make money. There's a lot of greed going on in the world. I don't know if you've noticed it, but I sure have, especially when it comes to metaphysics. And I think that's because it's, in many ways, an unprovable realm. You know, Carl Sagan, the great scientist, astrophysicist, scientist, he despised what we do, what we engage in, which always hurt my feelings because I thought Sagan was a pretty good guy, but he despised what we did. If I'd met him, he probably would have spit on me, or maybe, I know, he was a cool guy, wouldn't have done that, but he certainly would have not been very pleased with what I do. Neither would Neil deGrasse Tyson, if I met him, because he was a huge fan of Sagan, and they probably agree that with a lot of what goes on, and frankly, you know, when it comes to the metaphysical realm, there are a lot of people who take advantage of the fact that a lot of what we in metaphysics dwell in is very difficult to pin down, you know. And since the beginning of time, there have been those who have taken advantage of other people around the realm of metaphysics. But I will say the exact same thing about religion. They go hand in hand, in that whenever it can't be, you know, nailed down or nailed up, if you will, someone's going to take advantage of someone else. It comes down to the realm of faith. And faith is always a very vulnerable place. When I was 9, I was reading about seances, books in the library that were there, which fascinated me. And it was exposing seances and, unbelievable stuff. This book was just filled with lots of books and filled with incredible stuff. Turned out that the little town that I lived in, Fort Collins, Colorado, which was a university town, but the library was filled with books on seances and ghosts and stuff like that. And I was just, because I had grown up in a house that for a few years that had a ghost in it, and I saw the ghost, and it changed my life. And this was, maybe it was ordained, it had to happen, but it changed me profoundly. Who knows what I would have been without that experience, but I know that it happened, and this is what I was going to be because of it. So I would go into that library, and I'd sit in that section, cross-legged, and just sit and look through book after book, because they wouldn't let me check them out. I wasn't old enough. And they finally came over and said, "We're very uncomfortable with you looking through these books. And so we have a letter here. You have to get your mother or father to sign this and bring it back." So I just took it home and opened it up and looked at it and signed my dad's name to it and brought it back. I knew his signature, I think I was 9 at the time. And, third grade, that's good enough. And they were cool with it. My dad never saw it. But I was rabid about this stuff. Poltergeist activity and all that. So and I could tell with some of it that it was hokey. It was not real. You could tell. Some of it was actually books about exposing it. And I learned at a very early age that there were people who were out there to make money by it. And that there were people who were out there to try and help people, and they still use chicanery. And I thought at an early age, man, that is horrible. It's either truth or it isn't. So we are the ones who try to find the genuine article. We are the ones who look for the truth in everything, regardless of what it is. And I get really angry in my field when I discover that someone is not the genuine thing. And I've discovered it over and over again. Have I ever stood up and said this person's a fake? No, I haven't done that, even though I should, but I haven't, because isn't that terrible? It just isn't done. It just isn't done. Yeah, I know. I know. It's been that type of thing. Where I should have, pointed and groaned in agony, but I haven't done it. But it's been frequent, I'll say that, and in many different places in my life. But I've always walked as far away from that person as I could. And there's one thing that happens. Whenever someone realizes that you're onto them, the first thing they try to do is destroy you. It's the first thing they try to do. It's a strange thing. It's like, hey, I'm not out to hurt you. So I know what's up. I know who you are. But it's the first thing that happens. And it's a strange thing, I figure just live and let live. Live and let live. Just be who you are. But you and I, we search. I collect different types of divination. Different forms. You probably have heard of Walter Old. Walter Gorn Old. But he goes by the name of, what's his name? He wrote book after book after book on the mysterious stuff, and I can't remember. I know if I used his name. What's his name? Walter Gorn Old. You probably know it, and I can't think of it right now. I've got a lot of his old books, and they went into reprint, obviously, because they're all out of copyright. But very, very well-known. Safariel. Yeah, Safariel. And his books are fascinating, because it's like he went around and collected all this weird stuff. And there was a version of of divination, where what he did is, it was just numbers. And I don't know where he got it, but this was a version of divination where you memorize numbers from like 1 to 1,000. And you would tell someone to think of a number, and they would think of a number, and you would then have this divination based on that. And I really did try that. I didn't try and memorize it. I've got the book here somewhere. And it was fascinating to kind of play with, but I didn't think it was very good. You know, sometimes you'd hit right on, but not more than that, you know. And he went to India, and he went here and he went there, and it was, and he wrote book after book after book after book. And I think he was really into it. He was really very, very fascinated with it. I think he was the real deal. I have a great deal of respect for his scholarly interest in the subjects. Some of his stuff is fascinating. He wrote a cool book on a kind of a theoretical form of astrology based on numerology and the name. And there's some cool stuff in there, like how to do a theoretical moon chart. It's quite good stuff. Turn of the century, turn of the 19th to the 20th century. Then you Arthur Edward Waite, who of course had Pamela Coleman Smith designed the most famous tarot deck there is. He gave her what to do, and she drew it for him. And of course, she's kind of lost to history. They called her Pixie. She was kind of cool. I really think I would have liked to have known her. She died penniless the year I was born, you know, but I really always thought that she was the real star of that deck, because she did the drawings. You know, they're kind of Victorian Art Deco. They're not Victorian, they're more Art Deco, but she kind of brings that energy with her. And look her up, Pamela Coleman Smith. You'll see a picture of her. I think you'll kind of fall a little bit in love with her. Interesting person. But and you could tell right away, Arthur Edward Waite, A.E. Waite, Aleister Crowley, of course, they were not real friends. They were contemporaries. Aleister Crowley was the real thing. He was a magician. He could do the work. But he got lost in the egotistical part of it, the egocentric aspect of it, and he got so far, he lost sight of the fact that magic is nature, that magic is simply about tapping into natural forces and knowing how to do so, something our ancestors understood, something religion started out as, but got so lost in the purple vestments and the incense and the peppermints and the, you know, crippling mankind. I mean, all that stuff is just unbelievable. By the way, the Strawberry Alarm Clock, they did that song. It's so trite. It's this and that. But it is a cool song. Incense and peppermints. You look it up, read the words. It's actually very good. It's so trite. And it's so, you know, is what it is. But I happen to think I had that 45 record given to me by my friend who is now a bishop in a church. My friend Joe. Bishop Joe. Bishop Joseph. He's not Joe anymore. I call him Joe, but I'd like to see Joe. Give him a hug. God, what a friend he was. He was an interesting guy. He's nothing like he was, of course. But my friends of the past, you know, those who are still alive are interesting fellows. Anyway, so it's these guys, Crowley was the real deal. He understood the workings of natural law. And so anyone who understands the workings of it, so to speak, can pretty much have a good chance at riding the bucking bronco, if you're careful. And he wasn't always careful, and he paid for it. He definitely paid for it. He never had what I would consider to be a good relationship. That's difficult to have if one plays with certain forces. As a matter of fact, he had a girlfriend in Berlin whom he brought to England, and she stabbed him in the lung. He had really bad relationships for the most part. Most of his the ladies he was with, and I've read a couple of biographies. I could read more, I suppose. But they went kind of nuts, and it happened a bit. Yeah. Relationships are tough when you have certain energies swirling about you all the time. And you have a tendency not to really be as present of mind as one might hope to be. His first wife went mad, alcoholic. Rose was her name. And so that became a very important part of his world. He loved her dearly. And he lived on Loch Ness, in a place called Boleskine. And I don't know if that's pronounced right. And Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin bought that home and was very heavily into the whole concept of the Crowley mythos and magic and so on. And some of that's in Led Zeppelin music, supposedly. And I don't know that much about that. And I not really don't care that much about that. So, but the idea is that magic itself, is simply about natural law. So while you cannot make a pig's, no, you can't make a sow's, no, you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, you can make a sow's ear purse out of a sow's ear, which is a disgusting thought, but that is the truth. So it's an understanding of how to use natural forces. And then he became caught up in the glory of it. He actually used to teach classes. And so he would do publicity shots and things like that because he had to make a living too. So a lot of what you see, a lot of the more sinister looking shots of him are just to catch attention, to make money. You know, he taught people how to read tarot. I've done that. You know, you do it to further the art, but you also do it to make a buck so you can make a living, so you can eat, so you can pay the rent. It's one of those things in metaphysics that is very important. And he did that. So Arthur Edward Waite, however, was kind of a mystic, a Christian mystic. Let's make that absolutely clear. And they didn't get along so well, from what I understand. And at one point, Crowley wrote a living obituary for Arthur Edward Waite called Dead Weight, which I think is quite clever. But it is a scathing, horrific character assassination of Arthur Edward Waite. And in it, Crowley absolutely vilifies the guy. And basically, one of the things that he does, he kind of exposes Waite for what Waite did, which was, Waite used to go through and find manuscripts that were out of publication, and then he would go ahead and republish them. And I don't think he put his own names to them, but I think sometimes he was accused of doing so. I'm not going to say he did, but you can check up on that yourself. But he would publish things that had been... Anyway, let's just say that Crowley was not fond of. You can look it up. Look up Dead Weight. W-A-I-T-E. Yes. Dead Weight by Aleister Crowley. And Aleister spelled A-L-E-I-S-T-E-R. He was a very clever man. He was a genius, by the way. Without doubt, without any hesitation, I say that Aleister Crowley was an immense genius. His name, I figured out, if I'm right, I think I'm right, came from the fact that his family made Crowley Ale for many, 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 many years. Crowley Ale. And had a crow on the cover of the bottle, on the label of the bottle. And so his name was, I believe, Edward Alexander Crowley, and he didn't like either name. So he took a name, and the name Aleister, right, like a minister or a barrister, Aleister, you see? Alister, which means someone who makes ale. I love that. He's very clever. So he became Alister, but it really is a man who makes ale. Not that he made it, I don't know. He was a chemist. He was a brilliant chemist, and he was extremely good at it. He got kicked out of schools, prestigious schools, for blowing up chemistry labs. He had a pocked face because of one chemistry lab, and he got shards of gravel and glass in his face after doing that, got kicked out of school. And he was also a mountain climber. He was a great mountain climber. He was a well-known mountain climber. And he invented some crawls that are still used today, his techniques. He did a lot. He did quite a bit. And he traveled all over the world. He and his first wife, Rose, spent their honeymoon night in the Great Pyramid, in the chamber, the king's chamber, whereupon she was, I think it was in the honeymoon, maybe not even in the honeymoon chamber, she was visited by Iwas, which was a spirit. A long story, too long. I always wanted to get into the Great Pyramid, into the king's chamber, but my family would not let me. And I don't mean my family, my parents, but when I was 18, we went to Egypt, and we went out to a place called Sahara City, which was just a series of cabins not far from the pyramids. And I said, let's go. I want to go. I want to see the pyramid. I want to get in the king's chamber. And they kept stalling and stalling and stalling and stalling. And I was going crazy. This was in December. And as soon as, you know, the sun goes down, it gets pretty cold on the desert. And I said, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. I want to go. I want to go. You know, and it's like, Jesus, come on, let's go. And they kept stalling and stalling. And my dad's cousin was the undersecretary of tourism. So come on, he was going to get us in. It wouldn't cost anything. Come on, come on, come on, come on. Let's go, let's go, let's go. I'm 18. I want to see this. I can get in there. I can squat, you know. And so finally, okay, Jesus, will someone cut the, you know, shut this boy up from Great Honk. Shut him up. So we finally get over there, and it's closed. 4:30 was, they closed it. And I was just so disappointed. The sun is going down, so disappointed. I was really disappointed. I wanted to go in the king's chamber because, you know, it was a big deal for me. So I didn't get to do that, but I did go between the paws of the Sphinx as the sun was going down, one of the most amazing things that's ever happened to me. Won't talk about that today. But it was one of the high points of my life, my short life at that point. And I'd done some pretty wild things, but what happened after that was even wilder. So, but that was truly, that was when I realized what I was here for, and that was to do these sorts of things. Walking between the paws of the Sphinx and touching the stele of Thutmose IV was one of the, and it's huge. I didn't realize how big it was, or the Sphinx for that matter. But that was planned. They didn't want me to go into the king's chamber because they had this belief. There was a belief amongst Egyptians, native Egyptians, that certain Egyptians, like me, who were so into the ancient ways, when they went into the king's chamber, it could make them crazy. Crazier. And so they purposely stalled all afternoon so that I couldn't go into the king's chamber. He knew exactly what time it closed. And they would have opened it up for him, because he was the undersecretary of tourism. So they would have opened it up and given us a private showing, but he didn't do that. So they believed that there was some power there that would make people crazy, you know. And man, can you believe that? I could have gotten in there, and who knows, I could have gone totally nuts. But J. Patrick Flanagan, he's the guy who kind of really got things going with pyramid power. Pardon me, back in the 70s, he and his girlfriend spent some time in the Great Pyramid alone. And they did the deed back in the Great Pyramid, and supposedly it did something for them. But they were on Tom Snyder, The Tomorrow Show, and they talked about that. And that's not why I wanted to go in, but because it was just the year before that they did that. But they supposedly had some things happening too, spirit-wise. And so I was just dying to get in there. Maybe I talked a little bit too much about it. But They believed that, and they kept me out. So they viewed me as one of these people. They call it Faraoni, which I think has the word Pharaoh in it, but no one really explained. But I'd heard that word since I was a kid by my parents. So they didn't try and indoctrinate me in religion. My mom tried a little, but she learned pretty early that was a bad idea. And I learned some things that were bad ideas, too, about that. But which brings us right back to where we were talking about earlier. You and I are different. We're different than other people. We're different than the people around us. We have a different set of sensibilities. And we're a clan. We're a clan. We are. We're just a different sort of clan. Like when we get together at Thanksgiving with our families, if we do such things. Man, I always feel like different. I just feel different. When I hang out with people, I just feel different. Even people who do what I do for a living, I just feel different. When I teach a class, I love teaching classes. I love it because I always feel, these are my people. And I always feel like there are some people in that class who are kind of not like me, but then I think that there are people who are my people, you know? Like, you're listening to me, you're like me, you're my people. And I just love that. I really love that. It's a good feeling. We are of the same. We're not completely the same. I mean, I'm obsessive. I mean, I've been working on playing end blown flutes since that trip. I bought a ney, which is the name of the flute, a reed flute, and I've been working on it ever since. So that's like 52 years. And I haven't mastered it yet. I've got a ney now. It's a Turkish ney. It's a bit different. It has a mouthpiece, and I'm still working on it. And I fully anticipate that I can make sounds on it now, and I'm much better, but I fully anticipate that if I live long enough, I'm going to master this thing. I'm using it for shamanic work. I'm not using it, you know, to play the theme song to Daktari or something, or, you know, Eight is Enough. That's not what I'm interested in. I'm using it for my spiritual work, whatever that may mean, because that's important to me. What's important to me is to find myself, to ground myself, whatever that means, because that is where I think my life should be right now. It's important to me. I have an Anasazi flute, which is really pretty nice. I may have paid a bit but too much for it, but then people are into that, you know. What's it worth? Well, I don't know. What are you charging for it? That's exactly what I hoped you say. You know, whatever. But the point is that thing showed me something I could never have known, and it was truth. It was absolute. I could never have known what it showed me, but it turned out to be the absolute truth. Now, when something like that happens, you have gone somewhere and been shown something that you otherwise could never have known. That blew my mind. I say that without hesitation to you. It showed me something that I never otherwise could have known. That's shamanic, you see. I mean, that is, it blew me away using that flute. What happened is I played it for a while, and I'm much better at it than what I played on the show one day. I mean, that was just kind of weird, but I enjoyed it. And it took me somewhere, and I saw, I'll mention it, a date inscribed into a pole of a bridge. And I checked that date out, and the only piece of information I could find that it was even close to Germain was a piece of information so startling to me and so important that it just absolutely blew me away. And that information, I'm not going to get into it because it's very personal, but that information was absolutely solid. And it was the one piece of information I needed to know to help me to move on with something in my life. And I just said, how did this happen? And the only answer was, is that I was taken somewhere and shown something to help me, you see. And it was external. It had to be external. It was external. You see, it's a shamanic journey of some sort. And I'm not into that, but it was what happened. And it was the flute that took me there. So the same is sort of true with these neis. And Sufis use these neis and the whirling dervishes, you know, that sort of thing. But the ancient Egyptians used them too, without the mouthpiece. So it's a wonderful tradition, you know. And I love things like that. I used to use the tattvas. And I still, every now and then, do. And the tattvas are shapes. Look them up. T-A-T-T-W-A-S. W is the sounded as a V. T-A-T-T-W-A-S. And all they are, they're geometric shapes. Not like Lucky Charms, but you'll see them, okay? So like a brown square and a red triangle and so on and so forth, okay? Look at these things, and you can find some pretty powerful, magical things in the world that are incredibly simple, that are wonderfully simple, that are just absolutely mind-bending and mind-blowing. I love to have my mind blown. I love for things to just absolutely unzip my world. I love things to crack the wall. You know? First time I saw auras. And I knew it was true. I knew it was absolute. I knew it was real. And you realize you've been seeing them all your life. You just didn't know it. And then you see them, you know, you kind of, you say, I don't need to see them anymore because I can feel them. And once you begin to feel them, you begin to realize that that's a huge part of what we call being psychic, is being able to tune into people. I used to have people, I used to do readings in my home, and people would come to my house, and by the time they sat down at the table in my reading room, I knew why they were there 99% of the time, and I knew who they were and what they were about, because I was feeling that energy, whatever you want to call it. The electricity, the aura, whatever we do want to call it. It was a remarkable thing. You can do it too. All you have to do is open up to it. This is also very exciting, you see. It's also very exciting. Yeah. And here I am in life, kind of retired, to be honest. You know, my wife is older than I am by about 5-6 years, something like that. And something like that. Yeah, I don't remember rightly, you know. But and she just kind of wants me to be around more. And I understand that. It's a strange time. Getting old is strange. Getting old is weird. It's natural, but it's weird. My hearing, you know, I have hearing aids and you know, parts of my body are, you know, they hurt. It's just I didn't do anything to them. You know, I used to do lawn work, and not yard lawn work, but yard work, you know, raking and all that crap. And it would take like 2 or 3 weeks and I'd feel better. And this time it took 2 solid months. My back was out. 2 solid months agony, you know. You know, and now I'm finally feeling better. But it was like, this old stuff is weird. It's like weird. But that's part of nature, too. And you realize that turn, man. But that's the world. That's nature. That's how things go. And that's magic. That's how it is. But, you know, love is so important. God, the greatest feeling in the world is being in love. Being in love. I mean, you can love a lot. I love my kids, love my grandkids. I love being in love. Don't you love that feeling of being in love? That endorphin rush, that being in love, that, oh my God. That's something that is just kind of hard to reproduce. And you get older and you think to yourself, I would love to feel that every day, all day long somehow, just once a day, you know. The person who just figures that out, you know, just to be in love. I think I feel that with metaphysics. When you get that little turn on of something that happens and boom, there it is. Wow. How did that happen? I love this stuff. I love it to pieces. I love it all the time. I love talking to you. I get excited when I sit down to my microphone. I get excited when I know I'm about to talk to you all. Well, at any rate, it's been an hour. Well, it's been 55 minutes. That's all the time they like me to talk, because I can go on for 55 years, and that would be just weird. Hey, thank you for listening. I love you all. Until next week, peace and love, my friends. Peace and love. Don't take it all too seriously, even though it's awfully serious. We'll laugh about this someday. And maybe we'll laugh right now. Love you all. Take care. Bye.
Until next we meet, I'll be waiting for you right here in the Paisley Penny Arcade. 1, 2, 3, 4.